I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. Let me welcome you, first of all, very warmly to the National Gallery of Victoria, the Lowy Institute's events partner in Melbourne. And let me welcome you to this Lowy Institute event with the 2016 Distinguished International Fellow, David Ignatius. I see a lot of old friends in the Institute, some corporate members, and I must also acknowledge the distinguished former Foreign Minister and long-term friend of the Lowy Institute, Gareth Evans. Ladies and gentlemen, we are watching the weirdest election in US history. I remember well last year, I don't know if some of you like Stephen Colbert's performances on The Late Show, and I remember about a month before Colbert took over The Late Show, I saw him give a speech on YouTube, and he said that at this point, Donald Trump hadn't entered the race. And Colbert said, I'm just hoping that he stays in the race long enough so that I can tell jokes about Donald Trump. And he said, at the moment, I've got all these Trump jokes, but I've got no venue. So right now, I'm just dry Trumping. And I thought that was very funny at the time. But 12 months later, no one is laughing. The candidate of the grand old party, the party of Lincoln, Eisenhower, and Reagan, is the Donald. Some of you will have watched the Republican National Convention. We watched it in my household. We were glued to it. One of my colleagues was pointed out that there were more speakers. There were probably more attendees at the conference, but there were certainly more speakers with the surname Trump than there were Latino speakers, for example. The whole GOP outreach to America seems to have ended. Luckily, at least Melania Trump's speech was partly written by an African American. But apart from that, there's no inclusivity whatsoever. Of course, even if the worst is averted, and even if Mr. Trump is not elected to the White House, then I think the concern that some of us have, America Files, is that the forces that have been unleashed by Mr. Trump's candidacy will surely be very difficult for President Hillary Clinton to contain. We could not have a better person with us tonight in Melbourne to make sense of all this than the 2016 Telstra Distinguished International Fellow, David Ignatius. Let me tell you, just before I introduce David, that this program, this fellowship sponsored by Telstra, is one of our flagships. It enables us to bring a distinguished thinker and scholar and policymaker to the country for a period of a couple of weeks. We've had three fantastic distinguished international fellows in recent years. We had Kurt Campbell, who we believe will probably be a high office holder in a Hillary administration. We hosted Steve Hadley, who was, of course, National Security Advisor to George W. Bush. We hosted the former head of India's foreign ministry, Ambassador Sham Saran. And this year, we are really delighted to be welcoming the best read foreign policy columnist in the world, David Ignatius. His columns are essential reading because of the breadth. He has reported from all over the Middle East and all over the world. He knows everybody there is to know, and the depth, the way he fastens on a particular issue and digs into it and explains it to us and usually throws in a scoop for good measure. He is one of his country's most distinguished journalists, having worked at the Journal, at the Post, I think, for 30 years. He spent 3 years as the editor of the IHT. Just to intimidate us all, he's recently written the libretto for an opera titled The New Prince, based on Machiavelli's works, which will debut in Amsterdam next March. And I keep mentioning that, David, because I want to drive up attendances and make sure it's as well attended as your speech here this evening. On top of all that, he's a fellow at the Harvard School at Kennedy, and he's published 9 spy thrillers, which are passed around reverentially at the Lowy Institute. And I know many spooks who are Ignatius fans. Ladies and gentlemen, US politics has definitely reached a point where events are stranger than fiction. So who better to explain his country's politics to an audience of Australians than a distinguished American journalist who is also a great novelist, David Ignatius.
Thank you, Michael, for the wonderful introduction. I have found the last few months that when an introducer gets to that line about the opera libretto, there's a kind of shaking of the heads in disbelief. I know absolutely nothing about opera, but I am fascinated by Machiavelli. And if anybody ever asks you, would you like to write an opera libretto for, and I'll write the music, which is what the composer said to me, the answer should be yes, because it is really, I think, a unique opportunity. The only way you can tell a great, big, wet, sentimental story about the meaning of life these days is through opera. Fiction really doesn't allow that. You have to be much more astringent. And it's wonderful to be here. I want to thank Michael and the Lowy Institute for hosting me. I'm a Telstra fellow, which is a marvelous thing. Traveled around your beautiful country. This is the first time that I've been in Australia, so it's been especially interesting for me. It's wonderful to see my friend Gareth Evans in the audience. The last time I saw Gareth was in, believe it or not, Yerevan, Armenia, where we were both part of something called the Aurora Prize for assisting humanity or something modest like that. And I was the MC and moderator of this thing. It was a two-hour performance, and we had a dress rehearsal, and Gareth came up to me when that was finished and shook his head and said something like, "Well, good luck, mate. This isn't going very well." And Gareth, we got through that. So good to see you. I arrived in Australia a week ago yesterday, and I hope I've used my time well. I got off the plane and went straight to the ferry terminal in Sydney and took the ferry to Manly on a beautiful day. Here in Melbourne, my friend Tom Harley, who's in the audience, said, if you're really going to do Melbourne right, you have to go to a footy game. So I went to the Melbourne cricket ground and saw what I'm told was a very ordinary game. I couldn't really tell the difference between Richmond and St. Kilda. And nobody threw a banana on the field, I'm happy to say. During my week in Australia, I had gossip with almost everyone about the political troubles and future of Kevin Rudd, so I feel like I'm right in the middle of things. And I've even been very worried about the number of gold medals that the Australian Olympic team won. So as Michael said, I want to talk about the person who bizarrely is the most talked about, the most central, in a sense, political figure of our moment, Donald Trump, and the election that's ahead in the U.S. It is amazing to me that we've come to a moment where he is the Republican candidate. There's something about this process that's like watching a car wreck in slow motion, if you're me. I used to wonder, I have three daughters, I used to wonder why when I came home sometimes they'd be watching shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians or America's Next Top Model. That's another really dreadful show. But there is something about watching it happen live, watching reality TV unfold, the unpredictability of it, the just the strange sight of watching somebody who's next move is entirely unpredictable. That obviously is riveting. I found usually Republican and Democratic nominating campaign debates are just as dull as can be. I watched every one of them. There was something odd about just tuning in. I'll bet people in this audience tried to keep up with those strange debates to see what is this man going to say next. In trying to understand Trump, I, like most of my colleagues, got started early. I'll cite something I wrote a year ago, in August of last year. He promises to restore his country's greatness without offering a specific plan. He uses crude, vulgar expressions that make him sound like an ordinary guy, even though he's a billionaire. He's a narcissist who craves attention. And for all his obvious shortcomings, he's very popular. Who am I referring to? The column continued. Russian President Vladimir Putin, of course. But, the column said, the parallels with a certain American politician are obvious. So I wouldn't change a word of that analogy. I think time, a year, has taught us that there is something Putin-like in Trump and Trump's appeal. But I close that column with some words that I wish I could rewrite. I said, Americans have had flirtations with demagogues, from Father Charles Coughlin in the 1930s to Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s, but the bullying authoritarian personality, the Putin style, usually doesn't work here. History suggests that it won't last. I wrote that on the eve of Trump's takeoff, his steamroller ride through a Republican field that I thought had some pretty strong and experienced candidates. So clearly there was something that I didn't get right, and I'm going to discuss a bit of that with you tonight. I remember in January, as this Trump phenomenon was accelerating, going to the World Economic Forum in Davos, a place that I know I've seen Gareth at often. I was seated at a table at a big lunch, and somebody turned to me and David Gergen, who's an American political commentator, and said, words to the effect, this Trump person, you don't really mean to say that he could win the nomination, do you? And David and I explained that, yes, it was possible that he could. And there were gasps and shudders around this table of Davos men and women, people at the center of the globalization movement, at the idea that Trump might have some real staying power. Obviously, one reason that Trump has done well is that he's run against precisely the people who were at that lunch. And that's a resonant line. Before I go into the details of U.S. politics, I just want to note something that's an interesting and an anomaly of the current moment that deserves more attention from all of us. Obviously, Trump isn't alone in making this political style work in this moment. It's a strange fact that at a moment when the world is connected in a way it never was, in which information is instantly available, in which people you'd think are stepping together into the modern world, and yet there is this sense of uncertainty that new technology brings, the most effective, the most successful political personalities around the world share this make our country great, restore what we've lost. That basic idea, if you look at Erdogan in Turkey, Erdogan is recreating Turkey in a different image. You look at Putin in Russia, I'd love to say that authoritarian style, that manipulative personality will not succeed. He's enormously successful. You look at Xi in China, probably, for my money, the most successful and effective political leader in the world today, is also one of the most insistently authoritarian. I've been struck, in some ways horrified, by the success of, in your part of the world, of Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines. So something's going on. The people who can ride this particular wave in our hyper-modern, hyper-connected world, who do that best, seem to be, oddly, people who come out of a different time and vocabulary, you'd think, but maybe that's really the vocabulary of 2016. To return to the U.S., the conventional wisdom, obviously, is that Trump represents a revolt of the American middle class, ordinary people, against the elites. And I think this is one instance in which the conventional wisdom actually probably is right. That is what the Trump phenomenon is all about. A man I hope that this audience knows, Stephen Hadley, who was my predecessor as a Telstra fellow, Lowy Institute guest here in Australia, one of the people I respect most in American politics, told me 2 weeks ago at a conference that we both attended that people like me should really listen to the public mood, the implicit public statement that, I'm quoting Steve here, that globalization was a mistake, and that the elites, again I'm quoting him, the elites have sleepwalked the country into danger. I think that's the core anger in the country, that Iraq was a terrible, costly mistake with very little to show for it. The 2008 financial crisis was one that badly hurt ordinary Americans, people around the world, and the elites who caused it still really haven't paid a price. That's the core message. Steve, finish this conversation by saying this election isn't just about Donald Trump. It's about the discontents of our democracy and how we're going to address them. So I'm going to have some negative things to say about Trump and express some skepticism about his staying power. But I think the basic point that Steve makes is the correct one. If you look at the numbers, they make clear why middle-class Americans would be unhappy at their situation now. The Pew Research Center, which is one of our best think tanks, polling centers, estimates that the share of household income going to middle-class families in the United States fell from 62% in 1970. 62% of income went to this defining part of America that prides itself being a middle-class country in 1970, to 43% in 2014, 62% to 43%, while the share of income going to upper-income families rose from 29% in 1970 to 49% in this study. Those are really startling changes. That's a country becoming different. And it's not surprising that people feel it. According to another study by the Economic Policy Institute, which is a quite liberal group, but there's no reason to doubt these numbers, real compensation for the median American worker grew between 1973 and 2014 by a total of 8.7% in real terms, which works out to a 0.2% annual rate. And that's a picture of stagnation that leads to insecurity and finally leads to anger. And I think that, whatever else we say about the Trump moment, that is the issue that the next president, he or she, must address. Because otherwise, I think the pieces of our machine begin really to clatter. I've been struck since coming to Australia and speaking to audiences like this by the question that Australia faces, which is whether the Trump phenomenon represents a more fundamental course correction for the United States. Yes, we see their angry voters. Yes, we understand that your economy, like many advanced economies, has been growing slowly. But is this an America that's now retreating from the positions, even the values that we associate with the United States? There's no question that Trump does want to adjust the basic operating system. His one of his signature lines is "We don't win enough." Winning is his basic metric. Somebody said to me early on in the Trump rise that you need to understand that he really is the reality TV candidate, in the sense that reality television, when you think about it, is about winning. I mean, it doesn't really matter on Survivor or any of these shows how you win. It matters that you win, that you stay on the island. And we feel bad for the nice guy who got thrown off the island, but that's life, you know. Success goes to the ruthless, the guy who can get it done, and that is very much the person that Trump wants to present himself as. So for him, winning does mean rejecting some of the basic tenets of what we think of as American internationalism, our global engagement, free trade agreements. I'll cite his major economic speech of this campaign, which he gave in Detroit earlier this month on August 8, quoting from Trump, "Americanism, not globalism, will be our new credo. Our country will reach amazing new heights." You can just hear him say the word amazing. All we have to do is stop relying on the tired voices of the past. We're ready to show the world that America is back, bigger and stronger and better than ever before. So that's the basic pitch that pushed Trump through the primaries. Americanism, not globalism. And if you're part of a world that looks to America for global leadership, that's a disturbing statement that he is gonna change that part of the operating system. It's fascinating that on the same day that Trump gave that speech in Detroit, a group of 50 of the most prominent Republicans who served in Republican administrations going back over the last 20 years or so signed an open letter denouncing Trump, part of this really remarkable process of rejection of Trump by the Republican establishment. And this group said on that same day that he said it's about Americanism, not globalism, that Trump would put our country's national security and well-being at risk and would be the most reckless president in American history. So you can see the extent of the divide. The question that I've been struggling with, and I'd ask you to think through with me, is whether Trump, in voicing the anger that is felt for the reasons that I tried to enumerate, whether in voicing that this is the American future, whether he is an avatar of what's ahead, what economists would call a leading indicator of future change, or whether, perhaps, he is a lagging indicator. He is the voice catalyzing feelings that have been there for a couple of decades, gathering strength as globalization did sweep through the Rust Belt in America and change things. And I'm going to argue, and I want to just note a caution here. My greatest failing as a journalist, if I look back at my career, is I sometimes am too optimistic. So you've been warned. I may be looking for a meaning and interpretation here that isn't there. But let me make my case. All the polls make clear that Trump's strongest constituency, right now the only one in the U.S. where he is actually leading, is white men, in particular older white men, which is the demographic that has been, over decades, most affected by this process of globalization. I got my start as a journalist, I want to say believe it or not, covering the Steelworkers Union in Pittsburgh in 1976 for the Wall Street Journal, when the union and management were allied in arguing that unfair dumping of foreign steel was destroying jobs. That experience made me a lifelong free trader because the basic argument was untrue. It wasn't unfair competition. It was just better, cheaper steel. American mills had not modernized. They had not adopted new technology. They'd fallen behind. And they were in a desperate effort to protect themselves and protect bad management in particular, and also very high wages. So that's the point that I entered this debate about trade. So I look at trade and think about the group, the steelworkers who lost their jobs, the people who lost their jobs over the last few years in the Rust Belt, and they are demographically largely white men. So if you look at public feeling about free trade, and again, I'm going to cite the polling done by the Pew Research Center. In their most recent poll, which was published a couple of weeks ago, they found that support for free trade agreements has fallen sharply, by their terms, in the last few years. It used to be 59% of Americans supported free trade agreements 3-4 years ago. It's now 51%. But the interesting point in these numbers is that white men, the percentage supporting, is significantly below 50%. 51% still support it, but among white men, it's something like 47%. But here's the part that's interesting. This poll found that free trade agreements are supported by 54% of women, by 55% of African Americans, by 67% of Americans between 18 and 29, and by 72% of Hispanics, which means that the younger and more diverse the poll sample is, the more likely people are, in effect, to say, I understand that this is a global economy. I understand that there are disruptions. Obviously, we see a similar phenomenon in Brexit polling. To go back to polls that were done right after the Brexit vote was taken, The Guardian published a poll that said that 56% of voters 18 to 34 remain voters, and just 39%, 56 to 39, supported leave. Those over 65, it was basically reverse. 55% of those over 65 favored withdrawal. So after the Brexit vote, I wrote what I would say about the Trump phenomenon, that there is a danger that a leave victory, by implication, a Trump embrace of his views on trade, could, I'm just quoting myself, forgive me, could tie the country's future to the oldest, most conservative cohort of the population. One thing that has really disappointed me in this election, moving away from Trump for a moment, is that Hillary Clinton, seeing her need to keep trade union support in the primaries, worried about how she would carry New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, a year ago said that she opposed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's nothing that I can see that will do more damage to our future, and also, frankly, to your opportunities here in Asia, than for the U.S. to drop the TPP. It's not a perfect agreement, but it is symbolic of U.S. leadership in this part of the world, and failure to pass it opens the door for the Chinese, who are just waiting with a whole series, a whole structure for economic activity in Asia if the U.S. Can't get this through. I'm deeply disappointed as an observer with Clinton, her decision, the politics behind it. I was disappointed when she reiterated in her economic speech a couple of weeks ago that she would oppose TPP as a candidate during the post-election period and when she's president. And you just have to hope, if you care about the U.S.'s economic future, that President Obama will succeed in his promise, publicly and privately, to try to pass this during what we call the lame duck session of Congress after the election. He has insisted to Prime Minister Lee of Singapore, among others, that he thinks he can do it. He thinks he's got the votes. I know he's told Australians that as well, and you just have to hope that he's right. So let me, having talked about the issues that lie behind this election, talk a little bit about who I think is going to win. And we've got 3 months to go, and as I said at the outset, I got this so wrong a year ago that everybody's entitled to basically ignore my prognosis. But here's what it is. The polls tell us that the country as a whole is nowhere near as angry about issues like trade, issues like immigration, the Trump agenda, nowhere near as angry as Trump's supporters are, that it's just a mistake to see them as a proxy for where the country is. Right now, based on current polls, Hillary Clinton is a heavy, heavy favorite to win. The last average of polls, which was put out on Friday, showed Clinton leading by 5.7 points. This is a measure of the popular vote totals. That's down a little bit from where it was, down roughly a point from where it was immediately after the Democratic Convention, and there's some analysts who would say, looking at the numbers, that there's a danger for her that she peaked after the conventions. There was one poll that was released last Thursday, again from the Pew Research Center, which is a kind of gold standard poll, that showed her leading by just 4 percentage points, narrower than that average that I gave you. So there's some concern, but still, at this point in an election, 4 points is a lot to make up. More to the point, the popular vote totals and polling about popular vote ignores the possibility that there could be a much larger margin of victory in the Electoral College. America, as most of you probably know, has an interesting system. Presidential elections are not a beauty contest where the winner is the winner of the popular vote, but it goes state by state, and then the totals in the Electoral College are added up. And what that ends up meaning is that modern presidential elections really are determined by a small number, about 10, so-called battleground states, where most states in America, you know pretty much who's likely to win. There's no way a Republican today is going to win California, probably not New York. But these battleground states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, go through that Rust Belt area, are thought to be up for grabs. And that's where the election is decided. And Clinton is now ahead in every one of those. The numbers vary depending on which poll you look at, but they're pretty substantial. She's ahead by 11 or 12 points, depending on the poll, in Virginia. Virginia, in recent memory, was a red state. Virginia voted Republican. Not anymore. Barack Obama carried Virginia. She's ahead by 5 to 13 points, depending on the poll, in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, if there was a state where you'd say these angry voters who were upset about the effects of globalization, that state would be Pennsylvania. She's way ahead there. She's ahead by somewhere between 4 and 8 points in Ohio. Again, a state that's been hurt by job loss, hurt by companies moving overseas. And she's ahead by somewhere between 4 and 9 points in Florida. The simple fact is that if Trump can't win Ohio and Florida in particular, there's no way that he can win the presidency. It's simply not possible. When a website called Real Clear Politics, if you want to be a political junkie in the next 3 months, just type into the search box Real Clear Politics and you get more than you could possibly imagine or want. Their current election map shows that based on likely vote totals, Clinton will have at least 272 electoral votes. They count for Trump just 154 likely electoral votes, the rest toss-ups. That gives her already 2 more than she needs. So at this point, the people who do the best polling think it's as I say, a heavy bet. There's a pollster called Nate Silver, who used to work for the New York Times, has a site called 538, a very high-end, sophisticated statistical analysis. He currently rates the likelihood of a Clinton victory based on all sorts of algorithms he runs into his computers at 86%. That's 3 points less than he forecast a couple weeks ago, reflecting the slight slippage in poll numbers, but that's still overwhelming, 86% chance that she'll win. So obviously the question, since we all spent the spring thinking that Donald Trump was the face of the future, he was on a roll, he won primary after primary, confounding the analysts, what happened? Why is he doing so badly now, running against a candidate who, frankly, is not all that popular, has not historically been all that strong a candidate? But the first point to make is that he was never as popular with the general electorate as he was, as I mentioned earlier, with Republican primary voters. Nate Silver, who I cited earlier, notes that Trump, as he likes to brag, won the largest number of votes ever in Republican primaries. He won 14 million votes. No Republican has ever gotten that big a total. But to win the presidency, he'll have to win about 65 million votes. He'll have to win four times as many votes as he got in getting the nomination. And they just, right now, don't seem to be there. Silver notes that back in January, when Trump was just surging toward what was ultimately his victory, he had nationally, supposed in the Republican electorate, nationally had a 58% unfavorable rating. People didn't like him back then. That unfavorable rating is now 65%. He's more unpopular now than he was then. So that, again, in the country as a whole, there's just a different picture. Silver did a study of these swing states, these battleground states, and found that Trump had a 37% favorability rating in those states compared to 44% for Clinton. She's not wildly popular, but compared to Trump, it's pretty good. And Silver says, okay, let's assume he does somewhat better and gets up to 39%. 39% is the total of the popular vote that was won by Barry Goldwater in 1964 and by George McGovern in 1972 in the two famous blowout elections in our modern political history. So as you look at these numbers, you say, this is a different race than the one in which we got to know Donald Trump. It has a very different feel, and even a relatively weak candidate is doing extraordinarily well. Second obvious point beyond that is that Trump so far has run a disastrously bad campaign. I mean, it's amazing. It is. Clinton's advisors tell people like me, this is back before either convention. David, you know, we're not going to talk about policy during this campaign. We're going to put 70% of our money and effort into telling the country that this man is temperamentally unfit to be president. That is our message. And every day for the last 6 weeks or so, Donald Trump has amazingly given new evidence that that's true, that, you know, that he is not fit to be president. I mean, the list of things, I'll just remind this audience, he attacked the mother of a soldier who'd given his life in Iraq gratuitously. He said that Obama had founded ISIS, and then when the interviewer said, well, you mean Obama created the opportunity for ISIS to grow? He said, no, I mean, he founded it. He insisted on that. He imagined that he'd seen a video of cash being transported, and, you know, insisted, his claim he'd seen video of thousands of Muslims cheering on 9/11 in New Jersey. He has this ability to convince himself that he saw things, and then they can't. I think in some ways, most worryingly, in this period, he suggested that the threat to our Second Amendment gun rights was so severe that, you know, but maybe Second Amendment people could do something about that, which was interpreted, I think, rightly as a kind of incitement. And then finally, he has warned that this election is rigged by Crooked Hillary. That's the phrase he repeats. Crooked Hillary is going to steal this election. And the reason, obviously, that that's so frightening is that it sets up a delegitimization of her victory if she wins. That be happy to talk about that in questions. But I think of all the issues ahead, that's the one that worries me most. That's where our political system really begins to rip at the seams. You'd think, given the success that Clinton has had in arguing that the man who made all these statements is temperamentally unsuited to be president, that he would seek to moderate his tone and find advisors who could help him do that. But as we saw last week, he just fired his campaign manager and hired someone who, it's thought, wants him to be even more aggressive. Our top political reporter tweeted after this man, Stephen Bannon is his name, after he was appointed, summary of what you obviously just heard this from Bannon. Huge rallies, gloves off. Love gloves off. I mean, as if we no more Mr. Nice Guy. Brutal fighting with Clinton, heavy emphasis on nationalism and populism. So that was the formula that our best reporter saw for the next phase of the campaign. I have to say that in the last few days, actually, Trump always surprises, he has seemed to moderate his tone. He said, I think on Friday, that he regretted if people had heard his words and been wounded by them. He never intended that. Over the weekend, it was announced that the candidate who had talked about Mexican immigrants as rapists, and et cetera, that he was forming a new board of Hispanic advisors to counsel him on appealing to this demographic. So it's possible that he's going to try to change his tone and hope that his difficulty is that everything he has said, all these comments that we remember, are on video, sitting in the Clinton video vault, and basically loaded up and ready to go. And it'll be very hard for him to argue against himself without doing the thing that he hates to do, which is to explicitly apologize, retract, back down. That just isn't in him. So I've presented a lot of reasons why, first, the Trump supporters may be a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator. Why Trump is less popular in the country as a whole than he was in the Republican primary electorate. So how could he win? Because you do have to ask yourself, how could I be wrong? It's anybody in my business needs to ask that question. So I have been trying in my mind to as the analysts say, run the counterfactuals. Imagine that Trump has won. It's November 10. We wake up November 10, and he's the winner. How did that happen? What were the events that might have led to that? So I can see a couple that are obvious. If there's a big new terrorist attack, bigger than Orlando, let's say 100 to 200 people, you know, making it the largest terrorist incident since 9/11 in the U.S., that would give Donald Trump an opportunity to say powerfully, I have been trying to tell America that we are vulnerable to this. I've been making that warning, and President Obama and Hillary Clinton keep telling you everything's going to be fine, and it isn't. And these people are dead because. So that would be powerful. We've had some significant racial tension in the United States over the last year. We've had incidents in American cities. People responding to police killings of unarmed African Americans. We could have a series of episodes, just a kind of chain reaction, cascade of events that during the election season could lead to people to feel that their cities were exploding. And again, the opportunity for the strong man, the strong candidate to say, America is in trouble, we need strong leadership, and I'm here to provide it. Finally, and in some ways most ominously, it's possible that a foreign intelligence service, say Russia, could drop information into the public media in the final days of the campaign, a week before the campaign. Suddenly, some of the emails that Hillary Clinton held on to could appear, and that might overwhelm the final days of the campaign. We always talk in America about an October surprise, an event that isn't anticipated, that comes out of nowhere and tilts the result differently from what you expected. So I think those, if you think about those events, you see that the numbers I cited could be turned around. I'm going to assume that that's not going to happen, that my counterfactual is in fact counter the likely facts, and that Hillary Clinton will win. If that happens, again, forgive me for maybe being too optimistic, but I think she has an unusual opportunity to try to fix what's broken, obviously broken, in American politics for a couple of reasons. First, there is this amazing defection of just about every prominent Republican in the Republican establishment from Donald Trump. 50 of them signed the letter that I mentioned. I was at Aspen 2 weeks ago with, there were 15 of the most prominent Republican names you know, and they gathered, and not one of them was prepared to support Donald Trump in our conversations. So this movement of prominent people, some are moderate Republicans, some are very conservative, but they don't like Donald Trump. If Hillary Clinton gets elected and is smart enough to open herself, her administration, to participation by people who are not fundamentally, they're not Democrats, they're not deeply in sympathy with her, but they didn't want the future Trump was talking about, I think that's a huge opportunity to fix what's wrong. The second reason that she has an unusual chance is it's at this point seems likely that the Democrats are going to do well in congressional races in addition to the presidential race. There's going to be some down ballot effect of this movement away from Trump, as analysts say. Already, Republicans in Senate and House races are in a very awkward situation. Just imagine the ads that people, their opponents will run, showing some footage of Trump saying, you know, horrible comments about women or about Hispanics, and then saying, does Congressman so-and-so agree with Donald Trump? He hasn't yet spoken out, but, you know, I'm here to say that I think this is unacceptable. It's really going to be powerful, and I think there will be increasingly among frightened House and Senate candidates more defections from Trump, just as a sauve qui peut thing. You're going to have to distance yourself, and so that could accelerate Trump's problems in the final weeks. The current estimate from my friends at Real Clear Politics is that Democrats are likely winners in 47 Senate races. Republicans are likely winners in 44. That leaves 9 up for grabs, but many of those, I want to say most of those, are in states where Clinton is likely to end up the winner. So there's every likelihood that the Senate, based on current evidence, will go Democratic, and that's just a huge opportunity to begin to be able to legislate. She, unlike Barack Obama, is a good legislator. I watched her in the Senate. She is somebody who has a history of working across the aisle. She had a lot of friends on the Republican side when she was a senator. Yeah, so she's a known commodity for them, and I think it's possible she could get something done. She has begun, maybe in a too early sign of confidence, to talk about what she would do, or she is not, but her aides are talking on background. We had a story in the Post yesterday whose headline was, "With a comfortable lead, Clinton begins laying plans for her White House agenda." That may jinx her. But here's what she's talking about, what you should expect here in Australia. You shouldn't expect her to move on TPP. I don't think she can do that. Just, as I said, you have to hope that Obama will get it passed. She will try to go at this feeling that the economy is stagnant, that there's no job creation, by bringing back fiscal policy, which really has not been used as an instrument. We've been relying in the U.S., as most places in the world, entirely on monetary stimulus. So in the first 100 days, she will have a big infrastructure program. Anybody who knows, goes to New York City, lands at Kennedy Airport, drives in, knows we have a real problem. Our airports, our bridges, our highways are a mess. So there's an enormous opportunity for spending. She'll do that. I think it'll be much broader infrastructure, kind of fix what's wrong in the country. She'll try to raise money for that by doing tax code changes, raising some corporate taxes. Our tax system is so screwy, it's hard to find your way through it. There's bipartisan support for fixing what's wrong, so I think she might actually get that through. She might try to deliver for the Hispanic voters, who will be a key part of her success, by doing immigration reform, which would be a big reach and could be a very divisive issue. She will send, I think, she'll travel herself, but she'll send a lot of emissaries to Australia, to Europe, all over the world, to see traditional Saudi Arabia, to see traditional friends of the United States, and reassure them America is back in its the version of America you remember more assertive, more forward-leaning, more engaged. That's where we are. So let me close here to take your questions with just a last thought. This election really is a test of where America is. There's no escaping that reality. We're a democracy, and we get to choose what kind of leadership we want, and we've had a good exposure to Donald Trump. And if the public votes to back a candidate knowing what we know about him, that's something that America is going to own. There is no escaping it. People like me need to stick around and try to hold him accountable. I sometimes said the other day that if Trump wins, the big choice is Vancouver or Toronto. But in truth, it's really important for people to, if he should win, to stay very much focused, hold him accountable, make sure that terrible things don't happen. I tend to think that Trump, if he is elected, would be much less crazy than his rhetoric. I think there's nothing in it for him to be a wild, reckless person. Anybody who's elected president probably wants to be a good president, and I would think he would do that too, if that's a reassurance. I'll close with one of my favorite quotes, corny Americanism, from Benjamin Franklin, quintessential American founder on that day in 1787 when they finished their deliberations at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. They've labored, they've finally produced this document. Turns out to be a magnificent constitution, and a woman is supposed to have stopped Benjamin Franklin. He's walking away and asks him, what have you done? What is it? And he says, we've created a republic, madam, if you can keep it. And that's basically, I think, what this election is about. It is a choice. Couldn't be clearer for the country. What kind of America do we want to have? Two versions of it. And our friends in Australia should hope, as I do, that American voters, the American public, will have good judgment. So let me close there. I'd love to take questions if there's time, Michael, if you want to organize that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I told you that David was the best read foreign policy columnist in the world. I told you that he is read in Beijing and in Moscow as well as in Washington. I said that he's read in the secret world by intelligence officers, and I think we had evidence of that today. As soon as David suggested that foreign intelligence services may seek to intervene in the US debate, we had a lectern malfunction. I don't think that was coincidental, David. I think the KGB is listening. We have about 10 minutes for questions, and I see some hands in the audience. Let me ask the first one. David, you gave a very optimistic speech. You argued that Hillary would almost certainly win. You gave us a couple of indications of what would have to happen in order for Mr. Trump to win. And then you just hinted at the end that if he were elected, he wouldn't be perhaps as bad as we feared. Let me pull you out a little bit on that. You are a very long-term informed observer of the machinery of US government. We know that the US government would wrap itself around a Donald Trump, and it would either contain and limit his influence, or it would give effect to it. Are you an optimist on that front? Do you think it would limit his craziness, or are you a pessimist? Do you think, as some people say, that if Donald Trump were elected, the chance of a nuclear war, for example, would significantly increase? And are there any examples from history that we can draw on? For example, Ronald Reagan was derided a lot before he became president, and yet in many ways, many aspects of his foreign policy were far more moderate than one might have anticipated beforehand. So are you an optimist or a pessimist on President Trump?
I'm a pessimist in the sense that I think he's just radically unprepared to be president. He's never served in public office. He, by his own account, doesn't read much. You listen to him during debates. I didn't talk about the debates, but I think Hillary Clinton is likely to really trump him, if you'll forgive me. So that worries me a lot. I mean, the permanent apparatus of our government is powerful, but we're also an executive system. The founders created a very strong presidency, and Donald Trump, I think, would want to use it. I think he would seek to do what he has said, which is cut deals with other big guys, you know, cut deals with Vladimir Putin to straighten all this mess out in Syria. You know, I think he basically would embrace a lot of the Russian positions, let them deal with Syria. He would try to cut a deal with Xi Jinping. I think a lot of the world's autocratic leaders find that prospect actually, you know, it's much easier to cut a deal with the big guy who's running America than have to get all this nagging, hectoring about human rights, et cetera. Trump would have to deal with the U.S. military, which is very big, powerful, and is already thinking, already preparing for how it's gonna advise him what issues it will list. Just a note, a final point quickly. When I looked at Trump's business career, what I found to my surprise was that although he used to be in the 80s and early 90s a kind of reckless, piratical businessman making huge bets, he almost went bankrupt personally. Four of his companies did go bankrupt. He was spared only by the tolerance, forbearance of his bankers who let him work his way out. And ever since then, ever since the mid-late 90s, he has been very careful. He doesn't put his own money at risk. He, you know, franchises his name, but it's not his money that goes into those hotels and buildings for the most part. So in practice, although he talks this great big, you know, game, as if he takes every risk there is, he doesn't. That's so maybe that would be the case as president.
Yes, the lady right here.
Thank you. Zara Kimpton from the Australian Institute of International Affairs. You said that Hillary has friends on the Republican side in the Senate, and you think that she would be able to work with the Senate. One of the things that hasn't been mentioned, of course he wasn't a candidate, is the influence of Bernie Sanders. How much do you think that Hillary is going to become less of a centrist and more have a more left-wing agenda?
That's already happened, obviously, on TPP. I think left to herself, if she could make a decision without the Sanders factor, without the Elizabeth Warren factor, although she expressed some skepticism about TPP, I think she would be supporting it. One area where I'm concerned is who will be Secretary of the Treasury. It's a key appointment. If you were going to reach out to a Republican, that would be a natural place. President Kennedy appointed Douglas Dillon, a Republican, to be his Secretary of the Treasury in what was an attempt to cross party lines. I think that will be much harder for her. I think Elizabeth Warren won't be able to name the Treasury Secretary, but she'll in effect have a veto maybe over certain names. Sheryl Sandberg, the number two at Facebook, is somebody people would love to see as Secretary of the Treasury. She'd be terrific. She used to be Larry Summers' Chief of Staff. You know, that's an interesting possibility, might be attractive to people both in the center and on the left. But already she's shown that she does owe something to the left, and we'll just have to watch that carefully because, it's really important to have people who understand Wall Street, can discipline it, but understand Wall Street in these jobs.
Yes, sir. Sorry.
Hi, my name's Eric. You were saying different scenarios where Donald Trump could win. I was reading today about all the new senior team with Trump have alignment with, I think it's the Mercer family, and he's gone on the leash since they've got involved. So if this family is pumping lots of money in for his campaign, do you think this is a dangerous sign? And where do you think Trump sits, given that he's got no policy, if he's not following the GOP platforms? What are the most dangerous situations you could see if he does become president?
I don't know anything about the Mercer family. I can't comment on that. I think that's one of the things that's really troubling. Experienced Republicans, whether they're conservative and hawkish or moderate and not so hawkish, generally don't want to have anything to do with him. Big Republican donors generally don't want to have anything to do with him. There is a real distaste for him among the Republican establishment, and it hasn't gone away. And he isn't doing anything to make it easier to woo those people. And that's You know, that's his worry during the campaign. But if he should get elected, who is going to be willing to serve in his government? I mean, you know, we have the permanent government, but you know, with the exception of the military, that's not the action corps you'd want to charge with responsibility. So that's a real puzzle, and who he'll bring in. The few people who's Mike Flynn, one of his defense advisors, very controversial people within the military, within their own background. So, but that's a puzzle.
Ladies and gentlemen, David Ignatius has solved many puzzles for us tonight, or at least indicated where the pieces and how the pieces may fit together. Thank you very much for coming out this evening to support the Institute's activities in Melbourne and to hear David. And let me ask you to thank David. I have learned much this evening, including a new rival for the title of worst job in the world, and that is a member of the Hispanic Advisory Council to Donald Trump. If I ever have a really bad day in the office, I'm going to think about how those guys went during that day. David mentioned a divide between globalists and Americanists, and I'd like to suggest that David fuses globalism and Americanism in the best possible way. He's a globalist in the sense that he's comfortable in any environment. He's outward looking and enormously knowledgeable about the world. We heard him tonight on US elections, but I assure you that on almost any region in the world, he has fascinating things to say. But he's also an Americanist in the sense that I think you are, David, a quintessentially American figure, if you don't mind my saying, in the sense that he's informed, he's outward-looking, he's internationalist, and fundamentally optimistic. And his message tonight was actually one of hope and optimism in a season of anger and retreat. We heard a different America today. So please join me in thanking David Ignatius.
Thank you. That's very nice. Thank you.